When military-aged men went off to fight in World War II, those left at home didn't sit idly by. From civilian training, U-boat spotting, and airplane building, we're bringing you four stories of civilian aviation during World War II in Homefront, a new limited series from Airspace and the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, sponsored by Lockheed Martin. Search for Airspace wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey moms, it's Mandy here, mom of two wild, wonderful teenage boys who both just wrapped up their braces journey with Shirk Orthodontics. And let me tell you, their smiles are absolutely stunning. But what made me really fall in love with Shirk Orthodontics wasn't just the results. It was how easy they made the whole process for me as a busy mom. Best part, other than five convenient locations, is they offer a free exam. Go online and book today at yoursmilemaker.com.
Mention code BACKTOSCHOOLSMILE at your new patient exam and receive clear ceramic braces valued at $450. Free.
Hello, and welcome to the Latin American History Podcast, episode 149, A New Australia in Paraguay, part 3. Before starting today, I thought I'd just mention a couple of things. You might have noticed that episodes have slowed down a bit recently. Over the last year and a half or so, I've been able to get them out pretty much every week. During that time, I've been living and traveling in Latin America, and so I had plenty of time to commit to the podcast. Recently, a few things have changed for me and my partner, and this has meant that I haven't been able to get episodes out as much as I'd hoped. I think that the worst of this disruption is over. And so, in the near future, I should be able to get back to releasing episodes as close to weekly as possible, although I may not always achieve this. I will definitely commit to releasing the monthly episodes for Friends of the Podcast. There's one coming out today, as a matter of fact. In the beginning of this series, I listed some of the extremely broad variety of peoples who decided to make a new world in their preferred image in this part of South America. Among them were the Confederados, a group of Confederate soldiers and their supporters and families from the southern states of the USA, who decided to flee their country in the wake of the Civil War to the slavery-permitted country of Brazil. So to provide a counterpoint to this series, this month's Friend of the Podcast episode tells their story and examines how they still exist as a cultural group in Brazil to this day. There is information about how to become a friend of the podcast, if you're interested, in the description of this episode. So that's more than enough about me and about administrative issues. Let's get back to the story of New Australia. As it's been a few weeks, let's quickly remind ourselves where we were. At the end of last episode, the utopian settlers had just arrived at the land which was to become their workers' paradise, and had spent the last few months building it up from nothing. They had made good progress with this actual building work, but the cracks in their society, which had emerged on the voyage to Paraguay, had deepened. Although the association was supposed to have a fairly flat leaderless system, there was no getting around the fact that Lane had been the driving force behind the project, and that he had necessarily had to make many executive decisions in the planning and establishing of New Australia, and that he was seen as the leader and person to talk to by the Paraguayan government when it came to external interactions, as well as the British one for that matter, as we shall see. This perception of Lane's control was made explicit in the informal names which came to be applied to the two emerging factions which increasingly split the community. Those who didn't like him were called the rebels, reasonably enough, although even that implied that there was some sort of centralized authority which they were rebelling against. Lane's supporters, though, came to be referred to as the Royalists. Not the Loyalists to the original idea behind the colony, or even the Lanists for supporting him, but Royalists, implying that he was some sort of king. There were a few types of discontented inhabitant, so let's go through them quickly to better understand things. Firstly, you had those who seemed to want to simply have fun. These people don't appear to have been strong believers in the political project, and so they seemed happy to get a free ride and not contribute. They also largely liked to drink, and so this caused friction in itself because alcohol was supposed to be banned. Some took to trading tools with nearby indigenous people for alcohol. As all property was communal, these tools were not strictly theirs to trade, so they were giving away common property, which would need to be replaced from common funds, in exchange for their own private supply of contraband. These people resisted Lane simply because he was the authority. An example of an incident of this type can be found when a man named Arthur Brittlebank agreed to fix the roof of a local in exchange for alcohol mixed into milk to conceal it. As everything was to be held in common, a man named Arthur Tozer, whose job it was to oversee the food stores, not knowing that it contained alcohol, demanded that Brittlebank hand the milk over. The demand was refused, and the confrontation turned into a fight. Tozer came out on top, and so presumably the alcoholic milk was put in the communal store. But unfortunately, we don't know what the end result of this was. Was it given out unknowingly? There was another set of people who were also not strongly committed to the ideological values of the settlement. Often being found in family groups, these people were driven by the same sort of straightforward motives which had taken them or their ancestors to Australia in the first place. Lacking land or riches, they believed that they might find it by migrating again to a new colony and end up in a better position than they had been in before. They found those early months living in tents difficult, and so saw their hopes stifled. Linked to this was a rough, but by no means absolute, correlation between those who found the task of building a colony from scratch difficult, and so became disillusioned, and those city dwellers we mentioned last episode. Those who had been recruited from the Australian bush and pasture stations often found things more bearable. A growing number, however, did not fit these categories. They simply grew to distrust Lane and his leadership. I'm sure there must have been regular little incidents and interactions which contributed to each person's opinion of him, but which are now lost to time. Some would not have liked the way he handled the incidents on the boat and the flouting of the rules by his hardcore detractors. One incident in particular caused a lot of distrust. And it's one thing to think that someone is showing bad leadership. It's another, more serious thing, to think that they are dishonest, especially in an experimental colony built on egalitarian ideals. And so, an important but relatively obscure aspect of the scheme, which had been overlooked, was how it matched up with Paraguayan property law. The country was happy to give them land to use, but it had not agreed to let them completely do as they like with it. It had not ceded sovereignty, and Paraguayan law still applied. It sounds like boring administrative detail, but to put it as simply as possible, land could be held by an individual or by a company, and so the association would have to be incorporated as a company, according to the legal definition of a company under Paraguayan law. All members of the project were made into shareholders, and a president was required, Lane, as well as three more directors, his closest friends. In reality, this was sort of a formality. The Paraguayan government would let them do what they wanted in practice, but it didn't look good to some for several reasons. There was some confusion about a 20-year timeline for shares to be given out as dividends. Again, this all sounds very capitalist and far from the non-corporate idea of everything held in common, but although in practice it didn't mean much, it did make it sound as though nobody would see any benefits until those 20 years were up. Lane could be replaced as chairman of New Australia by the internal voting mechanism they had decided upon, but now it looked to some like he was an unimpeachable president of a corporation. The fact that he had created a trust to hold all of the shares just made it look further, like he was trying to hoard everything for himself. I don't think that Lane had any nefarious motives, but he did all this quietly. Perhaps he thought it was all too complicated and genuinely unimportant to make a big deal about, but that was not the perception among many. They found out about it from the local newspaper, which both gave them the impression he was secretly scheming and that he had taken an investigative journalist for them to find out what was going on. But it also made things more confused, as nobody spoke much Spanish, so the details of the newspaper article were easy to misinterpret. Lane was in Asunción when the article reached the community, and when he returned, they demanded a meeting. He offered to resign in a couple of months' time when the next shipment of members arrived from Australia. Despite the offer, the atmosphere was now so bad that things had to change one way or another sooner than that, and the stage was set for a showdown. Simultaneously, Lane and a man named Fred White set off for Asunción. White was one of the most rebellious of the rebels, and he carried with him a letter to the Paraguayan Minister of Colonization, and probably also addressed to the British consul. You have to remember that Australia was a British colony at the time, so he was essentially appealing to the colonists' national government. The letter was a condemnation of Lane's leadership, arguing that he ruled them with a deliberate policy of isolation to keep news of what was going on from leaking into the community. They also said that the remoteness of New Australia would make it impossible for it to succeed. The letter asked the Paraguayan government for permission for those who were disenchanted with their utopia to be given individual grants of land closer to the train station, so that they could make a go of it as individual private citizens, in effect to leave the cooperative project. While the letter did eventually make its way into the hands of the British consul, it doesn't appear that it reached the Paraguayan minister. Exactly why is not clear, but it was probably something to do with Lane's counteractions.
Hey moms, it's Mandy here, mom of two wild, wonderful teenage boys who both just wrapped up their braces journey with Shirk Orthodontics. And let me tell you, their smiles are absolutely stunning. But what made me really fall in love with Shirk Orthodontics wasn't just the results. It was how easy they made the whole process for me as a busy mom. Best part, other than five convenient locations, is they offer a free exam. Go online and book today at yoursmilemaker.com.
Mention code BACKTOSCHOOLSMILE at your new patient exam and receive clear ceramic braces valued at $450. Free.
He declared that White and two other rebel leaders were expelled from New Australia, citing their drinking as the official reason for this, and he made sure that his version of the story was known to the Paraguayans. White discovered that he had been expelled while in Asunción, and so he stayed there. The other two refused to leave, and so the police came and removed them. 16 more rebels presented Lane with a petition, arguing that he was acting unfairly, and that now the idea of continuing with the project was impossible. As, they argued, this was Lane's fault, they demanded that one, they be allowed to leave and found their own New Australia nearby, and two, that because the need for them to leave was not their fault, and because they had worked hard at building New Australia, that they be given a share of the communal wealth to establish their own separatist colony. This share was envisioned to be a fair proportion of the wealth which New Australia could produce, given that they had put their wealth in and worked to make the colony profitable. But Lane rejected the idea. To begin with, he didn't want to countenance a split and have a rival settlement of separatists living nearby. On top of this, in terms of the money, while it was true that they had put their wealth in and worked on building New Australia, no wealth had been produced yet. They had planted fields, but not harvested or sold anything. There was no significant wealth to give, even if he had wanted to, and he didn't want to. Instead, he made an offer of giving a substantially smaller amount to anyone who wanted to leave. Within a few days, one third of New Australia's population had taken him up on this and left. They began congregating at the nearest settlement and train station, Villarrica. News of this reached the Paraguayan government, who became concerned. They had actually contributed money towards buying the land, and so they didn't want to see it abandoned. A British official, based in Buenos Aires, happened to be in Paraguay at the time, so he was enlisted to find out what was going on. Sometimes the way things were done in this era feels so innocent and charming. It's pretty difficult to talk to anyone with power these days, and everything is governed by policies and procedures. Today you can send off hundreds of CVs and cover letters, formatted to make it sound like you're talking to a specific person, but you're lucky to get an automated response. Most of the time you hear nothing for your trouble. If you need to phone up a company you are a customer of, it can be very difficult to speak to an actual person, not a robot. And even then, that person often has no real power to help. Sometimes older people say things like, just go and have a chat. They seem to have grown up in a world where access to people who make decisions is possible. And once those people see a real person in front of them, they will of course treat you like a human, not an anonymous application. Obviously, it doesn't work like that these days, but I wish it still did. Back then, it appears that sometimes people just did have a chat and decide what to do. The British official dropped in to talk to the rebels, and after hearing their side of the story, told them that he couldn't act against Lane in the colony, but he would see what he could do. Then he strolled over to the palace to see the Paraguayan president, asking if something couldn't be done to help the rebels pay their way and remain in the country. News of events were then sent to a higher British official in Buenos Aires, who passed it on to London, and from here it went to Adelaide, where the Royal Tower was just days from setting off again for Paraguay with the next batch of settlers. Instead, it was instructed to remain where it was until things became clearer. The official then decided to visit both sides of the dispute and try to play peacemaker. I mentioned in the first episode how a division would appear between the tough outback bushmen and the settlers from the cities, and how Lane had explicitly said that he wanted more of the bushmen because he viewed them to be tough and best able to endure hardship. Well, this relates to an accusation made to the official by the rebels when he met them at Villarrica. Many were from those city backgrounds, and they argued that Lane had favoured the bushmen from Queensland, as they were also generally better educated than the bushmen on average. They argued that it was their ability to scrutinise Lane's political ideas and leadership that made him dislike them and see them as a threat. They allege that he generally ran the place as a tyrant, and their complaints were met with foul language and insults. They wanted to go home, and so they asked the official to intervene with Lane. They knew that the Royal Tower was due to make its way back to South America, and so they wanted to get Lane's permission to be passengers on its return journey to Australia. The official came to the conclusion that some of what they said was made up or exaggerated, but he agreed to take their arguments on board in his role as peacemaker. He met with Lane in New Australia the next day, and has this to say about him. He talks very slowly and dogmatically. In fact, there is something academic in his whole appearance. He impressed me as being extremely honest and conscientious, and as being possessed of an iron will, but also as being remarkably deficient in the tact and human sympathy so necessary in a leader of men. His views are very strong, and would appear narrow to most men. To him, the Articles of Association and agreements signed are as the code of the Medes and Persians, and any infringement thereof must be summarily dealt with. He does not admit such things as extenuating circumstances. A man is either straight or he is not straight, and in the latter case, he should go. Lane argued that he did not need to hold a communal vote to expel the first three men, because breaking the no-alcohol rule meant that this process could be bypassed. He also questioned the official's right to interfere, arguing that although they were all British citizens, they held no loyalty to the Empire, and would probably eventually trade their British citizenship for Paraguayan. The official proceeded to put the rebels' complaints to Lane, who gave his defence for his choice of actions. Though the official seems not to have taken a personal liking to Lane, he did conclude that so far Lane's arguments were probably sound, and his actions reasonable. The official wrote that his politics were nothing like Lane's, and he felt no ideological sympathy for him and New Australia. Despite this, he did admire Lane's strength of belief in his politics, and compared him to Oliver Cromwell's specialist Ironside troops during the English Civil War, whose convictions saw them change the political structure of the nation. Most people would find Lane impossible to work with, he thought, hence the defections. But for those who could live according to his vision, something remarkable could be built in New Australia. The matter would be dealt with later, but despite the loss of a third of its population, New Australia would continue. The Royal Tar was given the go-ahead to leave Adelaide a few days after its initial departure date. Initially, 204 people were supposed to be on board. One man missed the boat, and two were denied because while they waited at the dock, it had been Christmas, and they had been unable to resist having a drink to celebrate. Two other men had not realised that drinking was banned in New Australia, and so decided not to go when they found this out. One of the rebels had written their side of the story in a magazine, and this account had made it all the way to Australia. It's possible that those organising the trip deliberately let a copy of this account aboard, and it circulated among the excited colonists, dampening some of this optimism. If this was deliberate, it was done to weed out potential troublemakers. Seven people decided to abandon the project before they reached the colony. Meanwhile, the Loyalists in New Australia continued developing the settlement and moving on from the defections. Having built the essentials, they now turned towards more noble pursuits. They established a sports club and a school where Spanish lessons were taught. When the new colonists reached Asuncion, they were met there by Lane. Although it seemed strange and counterproductive, it's possible that more attempts were then made to dissuade people so that potential rebels could be weeded out rather than allowed into the colony. Only one more man decided to take his family back home, however. It's not completely clear what had happened to make him so rebellious and ready to give up, having already completed such a long journey. But whatever it was, he was angry. The spark for his defection was a simple delay in unloading the luggage from the riverboat. He responded by punching Lane. Lane made the decision to send his wife back to Australia on the Royal Tar. The idea was that she would recruit single women there to address the gender imbalance. The rebels, however, did not get their passage home. Many coalesced into a new settlement, 12 miles from the original New Australia. This split in the colony was unfortunate for Lane, but he hoped to put it behind him, to ignore the rebel colony and bring his new settlers into their utopia. It would not work out that way. The new settlers proved to be even more rebellious than the first group. If you've enjoyed this episode and want to do something to help the show out, one thing that's really useful is leaving a review wherever you get your podcasts from. A huge thank you to everyone who's already done this. And thank you to everyone for listening. You've been listening to the Latin American History Podcast, written and recorded by me, Max Argent, edited by Alex McNamara. If you've enjoyed the podcast and want to get access to extra episodes, you can become a friend of the podcast. There's information about how to do this in the episode description. The podcast is also available on YouTube by searching for the Latin American History Podcast. If you'd like to send me a message, or if you have any questions, you can email me at historyoflatinamericapodcast@gmail.com.